Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, now we're live with everybody.
Woo-hoo!
Facebook and the Vibe Radio Network. Good evening, everybody. Glad to have you all here with us. And,
it's been a fun day.
Yeah. It is what it is.
What it is.
But we are here. We are excited to be here. We got some fun stories to share with you tonight. As per the request of our good friend Glenn, who lives up in this area, just up across the border over there in Maryland, we are going to be doing
Maryland State Park.
Maryland State Park, and the headlining state park is going to be good old Point Lookout State Park, a beautiful park. We've visited a couple occasions ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So
we love to camp up there.
Yeah. It's been a while because we don't get to go camping too much these days, but we need to get back up there.
Yeah. That mass peak.
Yes.
With ninja ponies.
Yes, ninja ponies. That's a story for another night. not very paranormal.
Just sneaky ninja ponies.
Yes.
And somebody else's camp. Not ours.
All right.
We're
so
good?
Yeah, I think we are all good to go. So, but yeah, so this is a happy, I think, belated birthday to Glenn. It was right around Glenn's birthday, which is why, Glenn asked for this. We were going to do this for him, and we are very glad to be doing so.
Hey, Mom.
Hi, Mom. So, gosh, we got, 30 plus people watching. Cool. So, yeah, awesome. Hope you all enjoyed the show tonight. But, yeah, so Point Lookout. Now, if you've never been there before, you've probably heard of it. It's, it's a spot with a lot of history to it, and also it's right up on the Chesapeake Bay where the Potomac River runs into the Chesapeake Bay. So it's out there, got this, very distinct kind of, land shape out there and a whole lot of history gone over there through the years. And we're going to go ahead, we're going to give you a little bit of a rundown of, the vast history of this place before we go ahead and dive into the stories, just to kind of give you a little bit of background of some of what's taken place there over the years. Now,
and Glenn says tomorrow the 19th. So happy early birthday.
Yeah, happy early birthday.
Yeah. Why are you chasing?
She's chasing the fire. That's why we have fire screen. So now whether or not you believe in ghosts and apparitions, poltergeists and all that, the fact is that Maryland's public lands have experienced more than their fair share of tragedy and unexplained phenomena.
It's the reflection of the screen. She's chasing.
Okay. unexplained phenomena. It's undisputable that the Maryland state parks and whatnot are very, very haunted.
Yeah, and they don't shy away from it. It's right out there on their website. So we had fun.
Yeah.
Diligent and gathering information, starting with theirs.
Now, Point Lookout, as I mentioned, is kind of situated there at the southernmost tip of Maryland's western shore. And it undoubtedly has the grisliest history of any of the state parks up there. Now, while it is spectacularly lovely, Point Lookout sits on a peninsula there, as I mentioned, at the confluence of the Potomac River in the Chesapeake Bay, and today is kind of, it's completely serene out there. It really kind of belies the history that's taken place there over the years between the lovely stretches of beach that it has and the dense stands of pine trees that are out there.
And it's also made its way into pop culture, too.
Yeah. Now, while it may be very hard to believe that Point Lookout State Park was actually once the site of the Civil War's largest prison camp. Mm-hmm. So of all the prison camps, very notorious ones, you got Andersonville, you got Elmira, you got
Belle Isle
down here in Richmond. Now, all those were smaller than the one that was there at Point Lookout during the war. So now, the point later that was later named Lookout, it seemed pristine to Maryland's first settlers that came in on their ocean-worn ships, the Ark and the Dove. They sailed up the Potomac River over 366 years ago. So it's been quite a while since some of the earliest settlers come in from over in Europe. And while it's breathtaking, beautiful, tranquil, and magnificent, these first awestruck first impressions, however, are belied a turbulent history that is followed on this peninsula, including Indian massacres, tragic fires, and deadly shipwrecks. The beautiful landscape has been unable to shake the spiritual scars of its past. Just to kind of give you a little bit of a rundown here, some of the scarring events have been of these. Now, going back to the colonial days, Lord Baltimore's brother, the owner and governor of the colony, died tragically in his mid-30s, and his son drowned in nearby Calvert Bay, right there in the area. Virginia Indians raided Point Lookout in 1648, and they massacred many of the earliest settlers there. Shipwrecks have haunted the point, and many a sailor have drowned in the brackish waters, and the sandy beach has become the grave for many. To prevent further disasters, in 1827, Congress ordered a small beacon light to shine the way for mariners heading into the Chesapeake Bay to the east and the Potomac River to the west. But trouble soon came to the lighthouse when its first keeper, James Davis, died while on duty. In the years that followed, additional lighthouse keepers also passed away while on watch at Point Lookout. Even the lighthouse could not prevent all disasters at sea, however. On November 11th of 1862, a Union gunboat, the USS Tulip, en route from Point Lookout to Washington, D.C., exploded, claiming 57 lives. 8 mutilated, unidentifiable bodies washed up on shore. In 1878, the steamer Express broke up off the coast during a hurricane, and 22 people lost their lives. And in that same year as the Express disaster, the popular Fenwick Inn Resort with its bathing beaches and 100 cottages burned to the ground. But, as I mentioned before, no historical snippet stands out quite as much as Point Lookout's Civil War years. In the 200 years leading up to the Civil War, Point Lookout became a popular summer resort, complete with beach cottages, a large wharf, and a lighthouse. With the onset of the war, people's attentions turned away from recreation in the area. Summer resort owners began to financially suffer. The U.S. government, needing a hospital to house casualties of the Northern Armies, leased Point Lookout, and Hammond General Hospital was built and received its first Union Army patients on August 17th of 1862. Early in 1863, the authorities ordered a small number of Confederate prisoners confined to the hospital grounds, most being Southern Marylanders accused of helping the Confederacy. Not long after the Battle of Gettysburg, the federal government expanded the hospital grounds and built a prison camp for Confederates. Point Lookout was close to the battlefields, yet isolated enough to make escape difficult. The site became officially known as Camp Hoffman, a camp capable of holding about 10,000 prisoners of war. 3 forts were erected to protect the prison, one of which, Fort Lincoln, still remains. As the war progressed, additional prisoners were assigned to Camp Hoffman, and in September of 1863, 4,000 Confederates were being held at the camp. By December, the number had more than doubled to 9,000, and by the following June, less than 1 year after the camp had been founded, more than 20,000 prisoners crowded the camp. Point Lookout was used mainly for enlisted men. Most officers were sent to Fort Delaware. During the prison's operation, filth prevailed and wells became contaminated. Men literally froze to death in Sibley tents, which were rudimentary structures offering little protection from the elements, but with one blanket apiece and very little wood. With money scarce and boredom plentiful, prisoners learned to occupy themselves making trinkets and many other useful articles out of various materials that were subsequently used for bartering purposes. At the end of the Civil War in April 1865, federal officials began transferring the prisoners south, and by late June, the last prisoners were gone. In just under 2 years, out of 52,264 Confederates imprisoned at Point Lookout, between 3,000 and 8,000 men died. Today, 2 monuments honor the memory of the prisoners who died there, the first being built by the state of Maryland and was dedicated in 1876, and then the U.S. government followed suit, erecting a second monument in the early 1900s. In 1965, 100 years after the end of the Civil War, the Maryland State Forest and Park Service began development of Point Lookout State Park, and today the park comprises about 1,064 acres.
It's a beautiful park.
It is a beautiful park, yes. With quite the tragic and dark history,
yes,
to it.
And they do have nice signage up and memorials up, so you can definitely go and learn about the history there.
Yeah. Now, of course, this does provide plenty of fuel for various forms of paranormal activity, which will take us into our first tales for this evening.
Yep. So we're going to go focus on Lighthouse first, because it is considered one of the most haunted lighthouses out of all the lighthouses on the system. So it still stands. It actually just got completely renovated, according to our friend Glenn. We actually have not been here, been up there since they finished the renovation. We were up there while the renovation was going on. But it's no longer in use. It did come into existence in 1830. It was a 1.5-story wooden and masonry building. And in 1883, another story was added to the house so that the two keepers and their families were allowed to have a little more space and be able to interact and, of course, complete their arduous duties that were involved in keeping the lighthouse and making sure that they were equally shared between the families. The Point Lookout Lighthouse was only a few hundred feet from the camp's spoke-shaped hospital, and it served as a stop as part of the Underground Railroad, providing refuge for escaped slaves from Virginia making their way north. In 1878, Congress authorized the establishment of the Coast Guard station there, which adjoins the lighthouse. While the station became inactive in 1937, it was not formally abandoned until June of 1948. Pamela Edwards, who served as Point Lookout's keeper during the Civil War, is believed to have been forced to allow Union officials to set up an inside space in the lighthouse for female prisoners to be housed. Unfortunately, they were mistreated, and in an interrogation room, they were tortured, and this really, really upset Edwards. She later regretted her decision to allow this to happen after she had seen the torture and the death of these prisoners. And this is actually believed that it may have made her a rebel sympathizer and helped prisoners escape the area. She was removed from her post in 1869. Point Lookout's first four keepers died while in service. The first keeper was James Davis, as we mentioned before. He died in the lighthouse only 3 months out into his service. His wife, Anne, who was often seen in the lighthouse, took over the duties until her death in 1847. She was a very well-liked woman, and she was known to have fantasized and talked about leaving the lighthouse to travel, but she never did. Richard Edwards became the keeper in 1853, but died from a mysterious illness in July 14th of 1853, so again, another keeper that did not last long there. His daughter, Martha, actually took over and served from 1853 until 1855, and her sister, Pamela, took over from 1855 to 1869. So when we say it was a family affair, it really was a family affair. The longest-serving keeper was William Yeatman, who actually served 37 years from 1871 to May of 1906. He's actually buried only 8 miles north of the lighthouse. Now, the keepers of previous generations did not enjoy the advantages of modern alarm systems to alert them if the lights went out or mechanical means for ringing the fog bells. If the weather was foggy for a week, they had to constantly sound the bell, and they had to take turns sounding the bell. The lighthouse has acted for more than 135 years until the Navy purchased it in 1965, and at this point, a automatic light was actually placed offshore. And it remained tenanted until 1981, so they actually rented it out. In the years following the closure of the keeper's quarters, it drawn interest of many paranormal researchers, and among them were Ron and Nancy Stallings of the Maryland Committee for Psychological Research. Nancy claims to possess highly developed psychic skills, and the ghosts were constantly trying to get their messages across to Nancy. Now, while this was happening, Ron was continually snapping pictures, seeing if he could catch anything. One of the many photos that Ron took at the lighthouse showed what appeared to be a headless man in a Confederate uniform leaning against the wall in the front bedroom. The camera had seen him, but none of the people in the room had seen him at that time. While seeing might be believing, the photo is actually not on public view in the New York Institute of Technology, where all of the records from this investigation are actually archived. Among these archived evidences are specters of a triangular kite shape that the headless soldier and other things that were not visible to the human eyes, but it did appear in the pictures that Ron was taking. Hans Hollister was also at the lighthouse with the Stallings, and his career, of course, he's written over 60 books and on the paranormal and had a short-lived TV show in the 1970s called In Search Of. He was tormented by intense psychic impressions in several of the rooms of the lighthouse. He could feel the pain and suffering emanating from a small bedroom on the second floor. And a lot of people actually feel this. They actually think that might have been the room where the torture was taking place. Others on the team included Laura Burke, Kevin Mack, Sarah Estep, and Kathy Bradford. The team successfully recorded 5 minutes of audio that included 24 different voices in the building and on the property. Both male and female voices came across. They were singing, talking, and often using quite colorful language. Inside the lighthouse, a female voice was recorded on the tower staircase speaking of my home, and that's actually believed to be Ann Davis, the wife of the first keeper. She's often heard on the stairs throughout the house. The voice of a young man clearly stated, "I was seeing the roar." Outside the lighthouse walls, other voices were caught. A young woman said, "Let us not take objection to what they are doing." Near the old roadbed where the prisoners were led from the steamboats to the prison camp, one man can be heard saying, "Fire if they get too close to you," which is thought to actually be a reference to the great number of prisoners on the march, and it was a command from a guard. Other voices are heard crying for help. Another said, "I was in the water." A voice of a young boy actually asked, "Can I play?" And an old man called, "Get off that pier." Near the Civil War Hospital, a voice said, "Bad shape." So they got quite a lot of evidence. And this, again, is the early, late 60s, early 70s. So it was quite a bit of evidence for that time period. Two other unexplained sounds actually turned up on the recording. In the picnic area, there was a blast from a steam whistle. And inside the south basement of the lighthouse, a shutter rattling in the wind. There was no wind that day, and the shutters actually had been removed years earlier, so there was nothing to recreate that sound with. Lighthouse visitors, including Dr. Holster's team, have experienced very chilly air in parts of the building, along with a rotten smell emanating from one particular room. Oddly, as soon as Dr. Holster made public his belief that the smell was from the tormented spirits of people that were held there against their will, those falsely accused of spying or having Confederate sympathies, the smell disappeared. It's like they needed to be acknowledged to be released. In addition to the unusual sounds and smells, many spectral visions have also been recorded, such as that of Ann Davis standing on the top of the stairs in a white blouse and long blue skirt. She's actually been known to touch people while they've been on the stairs. Several unexplained images have also appeared in the photographs, the most well-known one being that of the ghost of Point Lookout, which was taken during a seance in the lighthouse in the late 70s. In the photograph, Laura Berg, the former lighthouse resident, stands in the center holding a candle. To her left, there is a foggy form of a man in soldier garb, weapon, sash, and one leg casually crossed over the other. It appears to be leaning on the wall. Interestingly, this image is not noticed by those, again, who are in the seance. It was only seen later once the photo was developed. The spirits of Point Lookout are not content to manifest themselves only as spectators or as just in EVPs. There's actually clear evidence that one particular dark and stormy night, they needed to let themselves be known. So power goes out quite a bit at Point Lookout. It's located on a peninsula. The power is fed only coming in from one direction, and if that gets interrupted, if that line breaks, then the point is left in darkness. So, of course, everybody's always well prepared with candles. Gary Storrs, who was a park manager, happened to be there during one of those blackouts, and he said he lit three identical candles in a candelabra in the living room. He left the candelabra for a short time to go to the kitchen to fix some dinner. A few minutes later, he heard a loud sound come from the room where he had left the candelabra unattended. Being alone in the house, he immediately went to investigate the disturbance. The candelabra that he had left was definitely had a marked difference in the length of candles. One candle had only burned about an inch. A second candle had burned nearly 4 inches. And the third candle, well, that one was the hardest one to explain because part of it was on the floor. That was the original burning part, and that had been put out. But what was left in the candelabra was only about an inch, and it was burning. And he still has no way to explain that.
It doesn't add up.
No, it does not.
That type of thing just doesn't happen.
It starts to make me look at our candles behind us.
So I've got a couple things here. Now, Glenn, he's been in the lighthouse on numerous occasions, and he thinks that he actually was touched by the presence of Mrs. Davis there on the stairs in Point Lookout.
Yeah.
So he thinks that he got a little tap on the shoulder, and and then when he was outside the lighthouse, he thinks that he caught the voice of somebody crying out for help me.
Yeah.
So
very similar to what was already reported. When we visited it, I actually got ill in the upstairs bedroom, the small bedroom, where they said the smell was. So I picked up on the energies in that room.
Yeah. And got one more thing. Got another family from up that way, the Mackenzie Lewis. Asking for a shout-out to her and all her family because they're all watching, and her dad regularly does a lot of fishing around Point Lookout, and they're all watching tonight. So shout-out to the Lewis family. Glad to be able to do that for you.
Yep.
Thank you for watching tonight.
Yes. Yeah. So we got a few more here. Laura, as I mentioned before, lived in the lighthouse for a while, and she had quite a few of her own experiences. But this one, she actually thinks the ghosts were actually looking out for her that night, and she always never felt a negative thing there. It was always a very positive looking out for type of vibe. So the very first night she spent the lighthouse, she was awakened to the sound of a heavy or old-fashioned boots walking up and down the hall. She also relayed that one of the rooms, again, had that bad odor or smell. And some mornings she would hear a female voice at the top of the stairs singing. She could never tell what song it was, but it always seemed to be a happy, upbeat one. Sometimes she heard the sound of men laughing and talking in the south side living room whenever she went to check for intruders. She never found anybody. Occasionally, she actually saw one, somebody, and it was actually two people. It was two figures in the basement. They were transparent but foggy, and she couldn't tell if they were male or female. Another friend who was visiting her in the living room, happened to be in the living room alone, saw a woman in the blue dress, so we, again, think this is Anne. And she actually, as we mentioned in a prior show about Point Lookout, her own mother thought Anne had actually called her name while she was there. So that, you know, Anne seems to be very, very active. But the night that was most vivid in her memory, she was awakened by seeing unusual series of six lights. At first, she thought maybe it's a reflection from a boat or from a car, but when she looked outside, it was all dark. There were no vehicles of any kind outside. As she became more awake, she suddenly smelled smoke. She jumped up, raced downstairs, found her space heater on fire, and she was able to put the fire out, and she found out the entire wire was burnt, including into the wall socket. She realized that if she hadn't been woken up by those six lights, she probably would have perished in the fire that night, and that entire structure would have been gone. So they were looking out for her and looking out for their home as well. Another comment?
No, just question.
Okay. Other things that have been reported have been actually reported by the Rangers that are on duty there at the point. So one of them comes from Donnie Hamnett. He's a longtime manager and ranger at Point Lookout, and he has experienced many since the 1970s. His first occurrence happened on a warm day in early March of 1977. He had been a new ranger, only about 2 months on the job, but he was very familiar with the area because he had lived in the area for 25 years. So he was well-versed in the history. And on this occasion, he encountered an elderly woman desperately searching for something on the ground. When he offered the woman some assistance, she clearly stated three things to him. First, she required no assistance whatsoever. Second, she lived in the up the beach away. And third, where were the gravestones? Now, this is not the first time somebody's had an encounter with this woman, but this was Donnie's first experience. He had no idea about a grave site at that time, and when he took his leave, he turned back around and realized the woman had vanished. She could not have walked off or driven off without him noticing. So he was a little shaken up by this experience, and he happened to meet up with another ranger, Gary Short, and he was informed from Gary at that point in time about the Taylor graveyard that was on the property at one point in time. The graveyard's exact location is no longer known. It's been lost to time, but its former existence was well documented. Records show that one of the individuals buried in the lost graveyard is Elizabeth Taylor, and they actually believe that is who is searching for the grave. Evidently, somebody had come across a missing burial site and actually stole her headstone, and that was the last marker of this grave site, and so that's how they no longer know where it is. That grave marker turned up in a local hotel. So they do have the grave marker, but they do not know where it can be placed so that Elizabeth can stop looking for her grave, unfortunately. As I mentioned, several other people have encountered her. She's near the picnic area. That's where he encountered her. Now, other sightings, there's a figure that frequently makes its presence known on the point. As you walk along, you might notice someone, something, appear ahead of you as you get near a clearing. It seems to be a man, bearded, ragged, and gaunt. As he draws nearer, you'll see that his cheeks are sunken in and his eyes are hollowed out, giving him the impression that they might rattle around in his head if he were to shake them. His clothes, or what's left of them, are homespun. They're made of wool. They're too heavy to be the typically normal clothing worn in the late summer, and that's what he's often seen. He's wearing boots. They're dusty. The leather is cracked, and his gait is very loose. It's like he's been walking for a very long time. A canteen is slung across his shoulder, and a belt that would normally sit at waist high hangs precariously from sharp angled hips. You find yourself staring at him, expecting to make eye contact as he passes, but he continues to look straight ahead, seemingly oblivious to your presence. As he passes, you catch a whiff of musty, hummus-like scented intermingled with gunpowder. Though unfriendly, you are impressed by the accuracy and the intensity of what you assume to be a historical reenactor. A few steps later, you turn to take another look, but he has gone, vanished. You stop to listen. There's no sound, other than the twittering of the birds in the trees and your own breath. There's absolutely nobody there. And that is when you feel the blood rush out of your head and you start to wonder, what did you just see? Well, this is a common ghost that is often seen crossing the road, always in the same direction. Many of the rangers have experienced this phenomenon while passing in other vehicles at different times of the day, at different times of the year. The first time Donnie actually saw him, he immediately turned to the crossing site. The man was running using long strides. He first appeared at the edge of the road adjacent to one of the Point Lookout camping areas. He crossed the road, dashed into the woods on the other side, leaving the park property. The first thought was that he was a trespasser fleeing the area. Donnie examined the area but was unable to find any type of path on either side of the road or evidence of a human or animal crossing. He did not get a good enough look at the intruder to be able to identify him, but he did get a look at the attire and was able to describe it. Now, the site of this man's crossing is actually very near, but not by the original Confederate soldier cemetery, where they used to bury the prisoners who had died of smallpox at the nearby hospital. Now, it was believed that many of the prisoners would actually fake having smallpox so they could be taken to the hospital and then try to escape from there, crossing the road where this gentleman was seen. So it could possibly be a Confederate prisoner trying to make that escape over and over and over again, where he later on dies off in the woods because he's contracted smallpox.
Not a good way to go.
No. Now, the camp was actually nicknamed Lee's Miserable. They were packed in like sardines. Starvation disease ran rapid throughout the area, and so many prisoners died. They actually estimate about 4,000, and they were all initially buried in this mass grave. Later, the bodies were disturbed when they were placed in a Confederate cemetery on the peninsula. So many witnesses drive past the cemetery, and they're startled to see the still silent Confederate soldiers sitting there in their backseat of their cars as they pass by the cemetery. So you also have to watch out for that as well. Makes me think of the Haunted Mansion.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so the last area are the campgrounds.
Actually, we got a...
another question?
Well, not a question. We got somebody here who, Terry, says that they lived in the lighthouse.
Awesome. Yep. I'm jealous.
Yes. Lived in the lighthouse as a four-year-old.
Okay.
And Carrie's father has stories and... always got a very good and peaceful feeling when around the lighthouse, and when upset would often go back to feel better. So
okay.
Somebody
another person like Laura who felt watched after there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So Yeah, Carrie corroborates that with her own own experiences up there, and yes, we got Una here. We got a request to see Una. So yes, so.
Yuna's getting toasted by the fire.
And she's loving it. Lulu is sacked out right behind me. Pat's asleep, so she's all good.
All right, so in the campground, Chris and I love actually camping in this campground because depending on where your site is, you can be totally secluded by the bamboo and seagrass, or you can be out and having lovely breezes on the water. We prefer the breezes on the water because we play Fallout, and Fallout's actually shows Point Lookout in
Fallout is a video game that's set in a post-apocalyptic world that's fictional and all that, but it was you actually make a trip to Point Lookout as it's an extra kind of downloadable content thing for Fallout 3. The main game takes place in Washington D.C. and this little add-on content you can go down to Point Lookout, and it's nothing like how it's set up today. Of course, today's a state park, but in the functional realm, it focuses more on what it was like as a old resort town, mm-hmm. like it would have been back in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Yeah. So yeah, there's a running joke between us that the Mirelurks are going to come out and get you, which are the, of course, mutated crabs from nuclear fallout.
Yep.
And when you're in one of the campgrounds where it's surrounded by this tall, huge seagrass, and you hear nothing but little animals scurrying around, you really start to think the Mirelurks are going to come out.
You really hear the crabs. The crabs are down there, and you kind of hear them doing their little clicking, making their clicking noises and whatnot down there in the grass. And it's like,
So we stayed in that area once, and the rest of the time we go out to the point where you get the nice breeze.
Yeah.
All right, so the campsites at Point Lookout are not spared from the spirits of the past, as we mentioned before. Donnie has that one spirit that leaves from the campsite area. Well, another gentleman, Donald Goodman, had camped at Point Lookout with his family for years. And at 1992, at the age of 16, he was walking late one night with a friend, and on the road, he saw a tall, straight figure walk toward them, which in and of itself, not unusual. But as it came closer, he noticed its gray appearance. He said, "I couldn't understand why I couldn't see a face. The image came closer and closer until he was about 10 feet away, and I felt like I was in his way, but I couldn't move or speak. And why? What was wrong with me? Why weren't my eyes clear?" He continued, "Finally, we were face to face, and all I could see was a gray image. He turned, lunging upward a bit, and walked in front of me into a gravel pile and disappeared. Later, as I ran the image over and over my head, I recalled, I never saw his feet." Now, Assistant Park Manager April Heavens recalls her own campground story. She was working the midnight foot patrol, and at 3 a.m., a deep, low-lying fog hung in the night air, and the smell of campfires was lingering throughout the entire area. She said she walked around the Hoffman camping loop hundreds of times, and she had never seen a thing. But that night, she felt a sudden chill in the air, and as she passed site 145, she felt as if somebody was following her. She heard a noise behind her and saw a row of white square-shaped tents in the middle of the road. She ran for the camp office as quickly as possible and shut the door, and she's now a believer.
All it takes is that one experience.
It does. Now for the sixth sense, our pets, who can see things on a different level than us.
Which is very true.
Yes. Our cats actually think our place is probably haunted because they see things we don't. But let's look at our doggy friends. It is said that they can... I'm sorry, did I offend you with the doggy?
No, let's not.
I'm sorry, I don't have any cat stories. Anyway, Ranger Kevin Hooker Hook, had his dog with him in September of 1999, and they had an experience that made Hook a believer. He said it was a fall evening. He was sitting in the living room of the White House across the road from the fishing pier, and the room faced towards the road that the soldiers used to march into Point Lookout. His dog Timber was nestled at his feet alongside, and he said as they were sitting, they actually saw the thermometer show a stifling 100 degrees. My friend and I were talking quietly when the dogs ran panic-stricken into the dining room. Both stood at the door, and they barked continuously into the oven-like room. My friend and I were completely dumbfounded. All of a sudden, the room turned bitter cold, even though the thermometer still read 100 degrees. The room was stone cold in seconds. We could even see our breath when we exhaled. It remained cold for about 30 more seconds and then returned to the sauna-like condition. Hook cannot explain this chilling experience. Had to do that. Sorry.
That was all me. That was my editing. I had to throw that in there.
Because we like a Rimshaw.
Yeah. Now, that does pretty much exhaust everything that we've been able to find on Point Lookout.
Between what we did before and this, I'm sorry, Glenn, I've got them all. At least all the ones that are written and that are available out there to research.
If we do find new additional stories as time goes on, we might sprinkle them in here or there on future broadcasts. But that does that really kind of covers the gambit for
I know deep.
No, but that is not the end of our episode for tonight, because we do, of course, have tales from other Maryland state parks as well. Now, some of these are going to be just real quick little kind of vignette stories. And then we actually got one state park that could give Point Lookout a run for its money when it comes to the paranormal. And we're going to wrap up with that. So before we get to that park, which we will reveal when the time comes, we will go ahead and we're going to go to the far western end of the state. We're going to go and really fly across the state to that part of Maryland that, if anybody's from there, don't get me wrong, but people kind of forget that it's part of Maryland.
It's about this state.
It's really, really tiny. There's not much out there. It's sandwiched between Pennsylvania and West Virginia. And, it's really out there. And this is out in the Allegheny Highlands. We got Deep Creek Lake State Park. It's about consists of about a 3,900-acre man-made lake, and it was formed as part of a hydroelectric project back in the 1920s. Now, today, that lake is the cornerstone of the state park, which offers a variety of activities year-round. Now, legend has it that a Christmas spent their Christmas holiday at the Deep Creek Lake Resort area. Among the Christmas gifts was a snowmobile for Dad. Excited, he called his friends, and six men ventured out on the ice-covered lake on Christmas Day. The lake's icy surface was deceiving, however, and it wasn't long before their snowmobiles crashed through the ice into the frigid waters. Six men went into the lake that day, but only three survived. In the meantime, the man's wife had begun to worry because he had not come home for dinner. She was about to panic when there was a knock at the door. There stood her husband, shivering all over and drenched to the bone. But when she reached out to touch him, he melted away. Just then, a police officer came up to the door and reported that her husband was one of the ones that accidentally passed away in the lake on that Christmas day. Tragic tale of Christmas. Now we're going to go ahead. We're going to come back across the state and actually come very back close to close to the Baltimore area, just to the east of Baltimore, actually. And it is here that we find Gunpowder Falls State Park. And this park was established in 1959 to protect the Gunpowder River and the Big and Little Gunpowder Falls. Now, Gunpowder Falls is a prime spot for various activities, and it is hosted various areas as it hosts various terrain, ranging from tidal wetlands to steep and rugged slopes. Now, long before the founding of the park, a tragic family lived along the Gunpowder River. Legend has it that in the early 1800s, a couple and their seven children lived along the riverfront. This family was not a happy one, however. The husband took off with another woman, leaving his wife with their children. Of the children, there were six girls and one boy. The boy was the youngest of the children, and the husband had doted on him heavily. The angry and hurt woman began to resent the boy since he not only was the husband's favorite child, but that he also heavily resembled her husband who had fled. One dark and stormy night, when the children were asleep, she took the boy from his bed, walked him down to the river, and held his head underwater until he drowned. If you visit this area at dusk and listen closely, you might just hear voices in the woods and a child scream. Some have even reported seeing a small boy running along the path. Ghost children.
Yeah, not my favorite thing.
Now,
Allison, don't go there.
Yeah, something else entirely, yeah. another broadcast. Now, just up the street, or just not too far from Gunpowder Falls, there is another park to the north called Rocks State Park. Now, this craggy forest land offers some prime hiking and rock climbing, and it's also home to Deer Creek, which is ideal for fishing and tubing. Rocks was created in 1949 for the expressed purpose of protecting the King and Queen Seat, a spectacular 190-foot rock outcrop overlooking Deer Creek. Our tale from Rocks State Park comes not from the King and Queen Seat, however, but from another well-known rock in the area. In the park, along Chrome Hill Road, stands the Witch's Rock. On All Hallows' Eve, at least one unsuspecting traveler will get spooked while driving by this feature, for that is the night of the Coven of Witches returns to the area they used for their unholy ceremonies back in the 1700s. One spooky tale has that a couple drove by Witch's Rock one Halloween evening and saw their names prominently painted on the Witch's Rock. Frightened, they quickly drove home. But, overcome by curiosity, they returned by the light of day, only to find moss growing over the rock where their names had mysteriously appeared the night before. Apparently, many other people have had the same experience. Excuse me. Just a little bit.
All right, so we're going to go over to Rosaryville State Park. This is just southeast of Washington, D.C., and it's near Mount Airy Mansion. Now, this beautiful colonial area was built in the 1750s, and the land that it sits on may have been used as a hunting camp for the Lords of Baltimore as far back as the 1670s. The mansion is the cornerstone of the Rosaryville State Park. The fifth Lord Baltimore, Benedict Calvert, resided in the home and hosted many visitors there during his time, including future General and President George Washington. Other notable guests in the years since have included Presidents Hoover, Taft, Coolidge, and Wilson. In the years since the original construction, the building has seen many additions and renovations. The most significant and major renovation was after a devastating fire in 1931 that burned all but the masonry walls. With so much history as Mount Airy is home to, it's no surprise that there are a number of ghosts rumored to be there as well. In fact, during the building's restoration, the contractors refused to work on the house after dark. The London Society for Psychological Research visited the home in the 1930s and claimed to have detected the ghost of Elizabeth Bresco Calvert haunting the mansion in search of her missing jewels, which she is rumored to have hidden throughout the home when she lived there. Among the other spirits is that of Miss Eleanor Calvert, who reportedly always kept her front parlor locked. Upon her death in 1902, that very room where her body was laid out on the night before her burial service, and the next morning the doors to that parlor were locked and the visitors were forced to break in. Inside the room on the table next to Miss Calvert's coffin, they found the keys to the parlor doors. She's still particular about things and death.
She likes things the way she likes them.
All right, so
I find that's a pretty common theme amongst ghosts.
Yeah.
They like things the way they are, and they don't like change.
Yeah, and if you're going to change something and they disagree to it, they're not going to let you in. All right, so we're going to jump off to our last stage four.
Yes. Now, as I said, this last one, this is the one location that can give a point look at or run for its money when it comes to
yes.
the paranormal.
After reading this, I'm like, I want to go camping here.
Yeah, we have not been here at all, but it's not too difficult to get to. It's just a longer drive.
Yeah.
Because this is at the extreme southeast end of Maryland. So it's just north of Virginia's eastern shore. So go all the way out to as far as you can go, south and east, right before you get to Virginia eastern shore. And this is the expansive Pocomoke State Forest. Now, before the establishment of Pocomoke State Forest, much of the land had been cleared for farming or used as farm woodlots. When the Great Depression hit, however, many of the farmers fell on hard times, resulting in the acquisition of large amounts of land by the federal government. In the mid to late 1930s, two civilian conservation corps were established on the forest property. So camp workers did considerable road and trail work and established boundary lines and provided fire suppression, fire protection and suppression. They planted trees. They performed recreational improvements. And simultaneously, the state of Maryland was also purchasing up lands for management activities. So a whole lot is going on down there about this time for recreation and conservation. And then come 1954, the federal government deeded all of its holdings over to the state. And to this day, the forest continues to evolve as a site for conservation and recreational activities. Now, it's not just people and woodland creatures that frolic in Pocomoke Forest State Park. This incredibly haunted forest includes thick trees, ghost towns, swamps, and an eerie, winding black river cuts right through it all. Tales run the gamut from ghostly werewolf creatures to spirits and specters roaming on moonlit nights to packs made with the devil to UFO sightings and just about everything in between on the paranormal supernatural spectrum.
It's a busy place.
It is a very busy place, which takes us to our first story. Now, one legend involves a young couple who were driving in the Pocomoke Forest and ran out of gas. A little cliche, but hey.
I sense an urban legend.
Yes. The guy got out to try and find some help and told his companion to wait for him and keep the car locked. The young girl spent the whole night alone in the locked car waiting for him and eventually fell asleep despite hearing strange noises on the roof of the car all night. When she woke up in the morning, she left the car at last and found her boyfriend's head resting on the trunk. Yes, the boyfriend's head was on the trunk. Detached place here. The scratching noises she had heard had been his nails scraping the car as he had desperately tried grasping for help as if someone or something had hung him feet first from a tree above the car. So, body, no head, scratching the car roof, head over up
yonder.
The side. Not good.
Definitely urban legend.
Definitely, yeah. Somehow she managed to get away to tell the tale, but he clearly did not. Another tale revolves around a bus driver that decided to take a busload of students on a shortcut through Pocomoke Forest. Things did not go according to plan, because if they had gone according to plan, we wouldn't have a story to share here right now, but that's beside the point. After getting out of the bus to check on some engine trouble, the driver was never seen again. The sounds of people walking on top of the bus as well as ghoulish faces in the windows terrified the students. The teacher had the students close their windows and went in search of the bus driver, only to find a skeleton in front of the bus. The teacher quickly took the wheel and drove all of the students back to school. Bus driver never seen again.
I wonder if she quit or if he quit.
The teacher. I think the bus driver didn't really have an opportunity.
No, but I have to wonder if the teacher quit. I would have.
Okay, I was going to say, would you have?
Yeah. Hazard pay and then quit.
Now, going to another story we have on the outskirts of Pocomoke is the Cellar House, which has a number of colorful legends and tragic ghost stories attached to it. One of these is that of a murderous, six-fingered sea captain who, according to legend, made a fortune smuggling, and used the money to build the cellar house in the mid-1700s as a gift for his bride. While he was away on a long voyage, his wife fell in love with another man and became pregnant with his child. She fled and gave birth in another village, but then tried to return to ask the captain for assistance. While sailing back to the cellar house, her baby was accidentally drowned, and when she ultimately returned to the cellar house at last, the captain stabbed her. It is said that to this day, both the cries of the bride and her baby can be heard near the house and along the river. Her blood still stains the floor where she was murdered, and even renovating the cellar house and replacing the floor has not eradicated it. Also, it is said that cars parked near the Pocomoke Woods by the river often have the captain's distinctive six-fingered handprint on them.
If any of you have ever watched Princess Bride, six-fingered men are not good. End of story.
Here's a classic one for you. You thought the one with the breakdown and the young couple and all that was kind of cliche? We got another one for you. Another young couple.
Don't go to this forest if you're a young couple.
Maybe we shouldn't go camping there. Or maybe I'm delusional about how young we still are.
We're 4 years old.
So another young couple had parked in the Pocono Forest to go and make out when a bulletin came on the radio. A very unique inmate had escaped from the Cambridge State Hospital. He had thick black hair, a black beard, and a hook for a hand. The woman demanded that her boyfriend take her home immediately. And as they were leaving, they heard strange noises near the car. When the couple got out to investigate, they found a fallen hook on the ground. In other variants of the story, the couple arrives home and gets out to find a hook wedged into their car door handle. Legend has it that this hook-bearing inmate has taken up the job of protector of Pocomoke, and it is said that he lurks there to this day, killing people who disturb the forest.
We're going to Point Lookout and not this one.
Patrick, you killed my father. Prepare to die. Yay, Princess Bride reference. Oh. Now, amongst everything that's happened in Pocomoke, now it's a forest today, but as you mentioned, it has its industrial roots. Now, depending on your point of view, this next tale might be one of deep devotion or unshakable stubbornness. In the decades and centuries before Pocomoke Forest became a protective conservation center, it hosted several industrial purposes. For about 20 years, from roughly 1830 to 1850, Furnace Town was a small but thriving industrial center right near the Pocomoke Forest. However, when the bog ore ran out, everyone left except for one person, Samson Harmon. He refused to leave the town he loved and stayed there long after it had been abandoned by everyone else. Harmon lived to be 106 years old, and he left instructions to be buried in Furnace Town, but they were not respected. Why, I'll never know. Now, it is believed that this is the reason why he's one of the most prominent and well-documented ghostly presences in the area. It is also said that Harmon's ghost keeps company with the many stray cats that now inhabit Furnace Town today. So, you're not going to bury me there? I'm not going anywhere then.
I'm going to move in with all my cats.
Yep.
Because... All right, so mysterious fireballs have also been a thing in the forest. One tale a man tells from West River was driving his car through the forest, and he saw something truly bizarre. A bright, fiery object that burned yellow and green blocked the road in front of him. As he drew closer and closer to it, it got brighter and brighter, and only for his car to shut off and stop right in front of it. Up close, it looked like a flaming yellow box. After a few minutes, the fiery box disappeared into the woods, and the man's car automatically started up again. The unexplained flame seems to have a benevolent side as well. In the early 1920s, evangelist Paul Walker was holding a revival in a church in the Pocomoke Forest, and several of the local women had been converted by Walker, and their unhappy husbands came to beat him up and burn down his church. When the mob tried to enter the church, they found themselves paralyzed at its door. A ball of fire then landed on the roof of the church, split it in two, and slid down the exterior walls of the building, terrifying the mob into departing.
I missed this because I was reading, and Patrick, you'll have to let me know what happened here. I don't know if he posted this before or after I got to the hook story. But he specifically said, all that's missing in this urban legend is the maniac with a hook missing from the asylum. Got you covered.
So they probably combined the two. And, yeah, there we go. I do remember that legend actually making an appearance in the movie Urban Legend.
Yes. So that one.
That's like the first one.
One of the most classic ones. And, yeah. I mean, even that kind of thing, it's made an appearance pop culture across the board.
Yeah.
There was something like that in Mad Max with, like, some guy... one of those. Yeah. So Cooks, Cars, Maniacs. Yeah.
So they all started in Maryland, just so you all know.
Yep.
All right. So the old church that has a mysterious Bible in it. Thieves be warned. In the forest, there once stood an old Nazarene church where now all that remains of the parish is an abandoned cemetery. The story goes that after the original church was closed and boarded up, a large Bible was left on the pulpit. Every time somebody tried to steal it, and many did try, they didn't get very far. For even when they managed to lift the heavy Bible, and as they would start towards the door, the Bible just got heavier and heavier and heavier until the thief was forced to drop it on the floor and run. It is said if you reached the door, the Bible would be so heavy you'd be unable to walk another step with it. I always found that one interesting.
Yeah.
I'm really curious, what did they do with the Bible once the church is no longer there? And I could not find that answer.
What was that?
What happened to the Bible when the church was no longer there? And I could not find
that. Yeah, no, I did a little digging for that myself after I was reading through the script and was like, huh.
Could not find it.
No, very popular legend story, but.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right, so they also like to, of course, mess with the tourists. So if you're fairly adventurous and you want to go for a walk in the woods after the dark, now it's close to trespassers at night, and some guided walking tours are allowed to enter. Many of the people who take the tour, and even the tour guides themselves, have reported feeling inexplicably touched while in the forest, from pokes and taps on the shoulder to all sorts of light, fleeting touches. People of all ages have reported strange sensations, so just beware if you decide to go creeping around in the forest. All right, so on to Goatman.
Yes.
Because I couldn't do this one without talking about Goatman.
How can you can't skip Goatman.
No. So we've heard of Bigfoot, Mothman, and other cryptoids. So here we have Goatman of the forest. According to the local legend, he is the man with the head of a goat and huge horns. He's very light on his feet. He survives by eating small animals and fish that he catches in the river. He walks in the swamp where no other man or large animal could walk without sinking down. It's just a small sample of our spirits and the creatures that are in this forest. Now, it does bring us to the end of our show for this evening. Of course, we do have more stories coming along that I'm working on right now, and
we're going to have there's going to be a president-themed one because we're coming up on
So that'll be right around President's Day.
So
I'm working on one of Loves and Lovers of Virginia and the surrounding states.
For Valentine's Day.
No, that's the first week of February. So it's pre-Valentine's Day.
Yeah, well, it might as well be Valentine's month for you go to the grocery store and that's just
wall-to-wall
hearts and pink and chocolate and
chocolate, I'm okay with. It's the pink and the red and everything else. It's not at all.
But yeah, so we got that in the works. We got the presidents. We got the love stories. Our take on love stories.
Yeah, it's not mushy love stories.
They don't necessarily live happily ever after. Newsflash.
Not at all.
And yeah, we got plenty of other ideas in the pipe as well, but if you have, if anybody has any other ideas that they'd like for us to cover, we're always happy to try and do so.
Yep.
Can't make any guarantees, you know, depending on the subject matter, depends on what we can do, the research and stuff like that, but we're happy to try.
And we did just do an overnight investigation at Denmora Inn, which was absolutely fantastic. It was five of us there. Got some shadow activity, got some ghost kitty cat activity. We raised a toast right before we started.
To the ghost.
And one of the EVPs that was caught was yes. So apparently they enjoyed toasting with us. We still have to review our information, and that's what I'm going to start doing tomorrow. I still got beer.
I finished mine already.
Would you like some cider?
Yeah, sure.
And so that was a lot of fun. And it's just a great place to go and stay out in Mineral, Virginia. You know, close by wineries and Lake Anna.
Yep, just 45 minutes up the road. So we're bad paranormal investigators. We were there Friday night. We still haven't reviewed our audio.
Like I said, tomorrow. I had to work. So tomorrow's my day off and I get to
go through the audio. We got probably like a few hours worth of audio stuff to pour over, but we'll go ahead. We'll throw together a little summary of what we found in a post in the days to come. But if you want to go on up there and check out Dunmore Inn for yourself, just look them up, Dunmore Inn. You can go spend the night. Beautiful, absolutely beautiful place.
They've got a lot of events planned for a weekend of Valentine's Day. So that like they've got a bus to go out to the wineries and a bunch of other stuff. So
yep. So yeah, if you want to go stay at a haunted location, no guarantee you can't necessarily do a paranormal investigation of the place because you probably good chance you'd be sharing it with other people. But you can always go on up there. Just beautiful location, nice little getaway just up the road from Richmond. And yeah, and you can go check out the other stuff that that part of the area has to offer. So I strongly recommend it. It was I had never been there before. Yeah. Went up there, didn't really know exactly what to expect. You know, we've heard of how beautiful it was and stuff like that, and how how good the bed and breakfast owners are and all that, but even with all of that good feedback going in, it managed to exceed our expectations.
Oh, God, far exceeded our expectations.
Yep, so fantastic location. Can't recommend it enough. So, yeah, check out the Dunmore, and as you said, we'll be posting some of our findings, what we experienced and whatnot, in a Facebook post in the days to come.
Yep.
So
with that, we will see you all in 2 weeks. Stay safe out there. We are still running tours. We will have a tour on Valentine's Day and also that Friday beforehand. And, of course, we're running the one a week right now while we're in our loose season. And we will be back the first weekend in February.
Yep. Glenn says, and we're happy to do this, Glenn says to please send prayers for Fred. He needs them.
Okay.
So we will be happy to do that for you, Glenn. And Patrick, thank you. Always look forward. So much fun. Oh, we always look forward to having them. You guys are great. I mean, we love being able to interact with you all here. And, yeah, this has been fantastic. This was fun.
Yeah.
Another fun episode. So thank you all very much for tuning in. We'll go ahead. We're going to post. We'll post our upcoming live stream and sometime in probably the next week.
Yep. And we'll go, of course, go back through all the comments just to make sure we didn't miss anybody while we were talking.
Yep. And as always, of course, this isn't all we do.
Yeah.
we're more than the live stream. We have our in-person walking tours going here in Richmond. And while it is the low season, we have got at least one tour going a week. So if you want to come out and see us and or our guides in person, please do so.
Yep.
Look us up, hauntofrichmond.com. You can go ahead and see what we got for tickets here in Richmond for our tours right now. So
yep. And we also do private tours. So if you're interested in that, make it out.
Yep, exactly. So with that, again, thank you all very much for tuning in this evening. And if you have anything, anytime, any questions, et cetera, drop us a note. We're happy to go ahead and interact with you, not just here on the live stream, but basically anytime you want to go ahead and drop us a note. So thanks again.
Bye, y'all.
Y'all have a good night. Bye.